thanking the Fields Institute, in particular Henry, for putting together the seminars here. So I'm sure it took a lot of work to get us all organized in line and so on. So thanks a lot, Henry. And the lectures Henry gave in his course, which some of you may have attended, were really very stimulating and wonderful, especially for me since I'm shying away from numerical computations usually like the devil. So I'm trying to become more numerical, and this is the outcome of it. So this is joint work with Serge Crook, another of Henry's students who is in Oakland, at Oakland University now. So the title of my talk is about a projection method, and here's a little outline. I'd like to tell you a bit about the convex feasibility problem, which motivates and sets the frame for this problem. Then I tell you about the main results, how you implement it to actually run some numerical experiments, and what you can say in the inconsistent case, and there are some nice open problems left, and I conclude with remarks and references. So here's the setup. I will assume throughout the talk that we work in a Euclidean space, so we have a finite dimensional Hilbert space with a canonical inner product and the induced norm. We also have constraints there, or you think about them as constraints, namely in form of closed convex sets, okay? So we assume they are nice and that the projection you have is actually computable. So we assume that these closed convex sets have projection operators or projectors associated to them. So what is a projection operator? It just gives you to any closed convex set. Here's a closed convex set C. It would associate to a point, the nearest point in C to this point, and that's the projection of X onto C. So this is the projectors we assume throughout, and they always exist because the set is closed and convex. The question is whether or not you can compute them. That's another thing, but we will essentially assume we can actually do it. The projection is beautifully characterized by these two properties. The nearest point has to lie in the set, not surprisingly. And secondly, there's a lovely angle condition here. If this is the projection and you have a point, an arbitrary point C inside the set, and you look at this angle here formed at the point PC of X, the angle has to be at least 90 degrees. And that characterizes the projection. So if you can check these properties, you know you have found the projection onto the set. The convex feasibility problem is just about finding a point in the intersection of finitely many closed convex sets. So you have these constraints, C1 up to Cn. You would like to find a point in there. So this is a pretty broad problem that covers, if you want, all of convex programming if you throw in duality theory appropriately. But most importantly, it's, I think, used in image reconstruction and computed tomography, where we have massive sets of constraints and you cannot do the usual work to get to a solution. So what are projection algorithms? So you have these convex feasibility problem and you would like to find a point in the intersection of these constraints, and the projection algorithms try to use the simple projections you have. If you have two sets and you would like to find a point in here, and you're somewhere outside, it tries to use the two projections in some way to get to a point in the intersection, at least eventually. And this is an iterative type framework. You won't get in there in general in one step, but it tries to combine the simple projections themselves to generate a sequence that would converge to a point in the intersection of the constraints. So in general, I drew on the board just two sets. This is how a projection algorithm would update its sequence that tries to converge to a point. So you have a current point, xn. What's the update? You sit at xn and you look at the cone generated at xn in the directions of the projection. So in this particular picture here, you would look at this cone and you pick something out of this cone, and you see in this picture, this is a bad picture because this is too easy, but you see this cone actually contains the intersection here, so there's hope that you at least shoot in the right direction, and you have to choose the weights, these are non-negative weights properly and a relaxation parameter to get there, okay? So you can't take arbitrary long steps, for instance, because you may way overshoot and get nowhere nearer again. So there are restrictions on the weights and onto the relaxation parameters. But this is the main idea. You look in this cone generated at your current iterate to try to get closer to the problem, to the set you're interested in. The grandfather of convergence results of this method goes in a specialized form back to Schwarz and Alternier in the Verfahren in some DE setup. But the first abstract formulation was actually proved by John von Neumann in 1933, published in the 50s, some, I think, Princeton lecture notes. And he proved the following very nice result. If you have two subspaces, so in the Euclidean plane, which I draw here, you have, say, two lines, and you are anywhere, and you start projecting onto the lines or to the subspaces alternatingly, you actually converge to a point, and not just any point, you converge to the nearest point in the intersection. Now, this picture is bad because my intersection is just a singleton, so it will be the nearest point to the intersection also. But you can actually prove this, and this proof works in general Hilbert space. A student of his, Israel Halperin, who actually was at Toronto, extended this to two or more subspaces, and the proof is actually quite different, and he proved the same result. If you go cyclically, so if you had three subspaces, and you first project onto the first, then onto the second, then onto the third, and then you keep repeating the cycle, if you generate the sequence like that, then indeed you converge also to the nearest point in the intersection of these subspaces. And if you shift these subspaces around, you get a corresponding result for affine subspaces. So this is the granddaddy of all results of projection algorithms, and this works even in Hilbert space. Okay. So what happens if you have convex constraints rather than affine constraints? Well, if you keep on iterating or generating your sequence in this cyclic fashion, the result still holds with a caveat. The caveat is you can only prove weak convergence, that's an aside, and you may not get to the nearest point in the intersection anymore as well, okay? So here's a nice example that shows this. If you have two half spaces, again, the Euclidean plane, and you use this as your starting point, you project, if this is the first half space, if you project down here and then onto the second half space there, you are in the intersection in two steps, but you haven't found the nearest point, okay? So you have to give up the idea of finding the nearest point, but at least there's hope that you find some point in the intersection, and in some cases that's all you may care for. If you want to find really the nearest point in the intersection, there's actually a very lovely modification of this von Neumann result that's due to Dijkstra, and that's not the graph theory, Dijkstra. He introduced a really lovely algorithm that is a direct generalization of this. So there's some dual variables involved there, and if you have the case of subspaces, the dual variables disappear and you're back to the von Neumann result, okay? And this Dijkstra method is used, for instance, in finding the nearest correlation matrix, and Miguel and Henry know about that. So there's a complete nice generalization of that that would actually give you even the nearest point intersection, but that's just an aside. For the talk, I will focus on the cyclic idea, so you alternate back and forth between sets, two sets or more sets. So this is the simple idea where you just keep on cyclically iterating the projectors or projection operators themselves. I'd like to introduce a little bit more flexibility here by iterating not just the projector but possibly something more general like the reflector or something that is under or over relaxed. So let me just draw another picture here. If I have another set C here and a point here, X outside, the projection itself would be precisely this point, the nearest point. But now I would like to allow in principle operators that lie on this little green segment where I overshoot by twice the distance bar. This would be the reflector, okay? And the reflector is mathematically defined in this way. It would be two times the projection minus the identity. So you can parameterize this little line segment by alpha, say. If you have alpha equals 0, you just have the identity. Alpha equals 1 gives you the projector, and alpha equals 2 gives you the reflector, okay? the reflectors themselves don't show up in projection methods for a good reason. In general, you just cannot expect any hope that you actually converge. Take a very simple example where you just have one set that's a singleton. If you're outside and you reflect, well, you go to the other side and you can do this forever. You get never any closer. So it's not surprisingly that there is no convergence theory for general reflectors. However, there's a few results in the literature that do employ reflectors. There's a classical paper in the Canadian journal by Motzkin and Schoenberg where they discuss these over and under relaxations. There's a classical method that goes back to Simino in the 30s where it's used to solve essentially AX equals B and you completely reflect but you assume your constraints actually have, they're not all lined up and then you take an average. So there's a few results out there where they are actually used and you can prove something if the geometry is right, okay? However, we were intrigued by the following simple picture, okay? So the following motivated everything that I'm going to talk about. Suppose you have two constraints and one of them is the non-negative orthons. Okay, so you would like to find a solution to AX equals B subject to a non-negativity constraint, okay? And what the usual cyclic projections would do, you would start here, say you would project onto the flat, you would project onto the cone, and you would keep on doing this, and you would happily converge to a point that satisfies your affine constraint and is non-negative. But what happens if you actually project onto the flat and then reflect into the cone? You see from the picture, if I reflect into the cone, I seem to get there much faster, okay? So this simple picture, Serge Cook and I, we were looking at, and we were intrigued by that, and we wondered if this picture is actually a lie. Is it only true in R2 where we can draw things and it seems to work out pretty nicely, or is it true in general? The answer, it's actually true in general. And what are the properties of the cone you need to really make the picture work so that this method actually will work? So I'm throwing in now another constraint, namely a cone, okay? So we have an additional constraint, namely a closed convex cone. And this is not unrealistic at all for applications where you may have the non-negative orthon floating around or the cone of positive semi-definite matrices, okay? So what do you need to make this picture work? So I'm going to tell you what the result is, and I'm going to outline the proof to you because I think it's a really neat proof, and it shows you how the pieces are actually all used to get it working. What you need the cone to satisfy is the notion of fatness. Okay, and this is called obtuse, and we looked hard in the literature, and actually Goffin defined this maybe 20 years ago when he studied also relaxation methods. So he looked at it, and more recently, Sagielski from Poland looked at this also in some projection-type methods. So what is an obtuse cone? A cone is obtuse if it contains its positive polar cone. So that's the definition of an obtuse cone. Okay, so let me draw you a picture here. It's easiest to take a little detour via the negative polar cone. So let me draw you a picture. So suppose this is the cone K you have. The negative polar cone are all the vectors that make an angle of at least 90 degrees with that cone. So here you have 90 degrees, here you have 90 degrees. The negative polar cone would be that. I put a K minus here for negative polar. If I look at the negative of it, I get the positive polar cone. Okay, so I reflect this. This is the origin. The positive polar cone would be that. And you see here, this inequality is not satisfied. This cone is not obtuse, and it looks kind of thin, right? It's not a fat cone, and the picture doesn't lie here. It's a notion of fatness, if you want to. So you have, this is a slim cone, so here it's not true. But if you open up the cone, the picture will change. So the extreme case would be that your cone is actually a half space, okay? This is, K would be a half space, that's the origin. The negative polar cone is just the normal vector, and the positive polar cone is just this ray, and well enough, this cone clearly contains this ray. So this is an obtuse cone. This is one extreme in the family of obtuse cones. If you want the other extremes where you have equality, where K equals K plus, and these are just the self-dual cones, okay, and they are extremely important in optimization if you look at the orthon or the positive semidefinite matrices. So the opportunist cones are somewhere in between half spaces and self-dual cones. There's a nice dual characterization to obtusity. K is obtuse if and only if K plus is acute. So this angle here. The dual cone is slim. Okay, so you can prove this by a separation argument. Okay, and here I just pointed out again the two examples. Here's the main result. It says if you do not cyclic projections, but rather cyclic projections on all the ordinary constraints, but you replace the projection onto the cone by its reflection, then the method actually still works. So you assume the intersection is non-empty, you have a starting point. While your current iterate is not in the intersection, that's easy to check by checking all the distances to the constraints. If one of them is positive, you're not there yet. So while you're not there yet, you reflect, and I denote this by this double plus, you reflect into the cone, and then you project cyclically onto the non-conical constraints or arbitrary other remaining constraints until you're happy, okay? So and the result, the convergence result, is if you look at the full sequence, so the sequence with all the intermediate terms, you actually do converge to some point in the intersection. So the picture doesn't lie. How do you prove it? Yeah. We haven't found a really, really very simple proof. I hope there's something simpler there, but that's the simplest we can come up with. So I outline you the proof, at least a bit, and some of the pieces needed to prove the pieces. What you need is you need that projections themselves are very nice maps. They're called firmly non-expansive. They satisfy this property here. So they are not just Lipschitz 1, they are even more. The identity minus the map itself can be controlled by the difference of two arbitrary points in the space. And this follows essentially directly from this characterization. So once you have this characterization, which you can get from convex optimization, you can prove that, and it's not too bad. The next result you need is you need to know something about the reflector because it shows up in the algorithm after all. You can at least prove that the reflector, while it's not firmly non-expansive, at least it's non-expansive. At least it's Lipschitz 1. So that's one property you can save. So it's a Lipschitz 1 map. That's good. It's nice continuous. And here's, I think, the really key property that shows why this method will work. It turns out that this is actually for an arbitrary closed convex non-empty set. If we here now go to a cone, then you can prove that the cone is obtuse if and only if the range of the reflection is actually the cone itself. Okay, so you don't leave the cone. This is in some sense why the method will not work for thin cones, because if you're way out here and you reflect, you kind of leave the cone. This will never happen for an obtuse cone. You will always stay nicely in the cone. Okay, but from a fixed point theoretical or non-expansive mapping point of view, the reflector is really, really bad. There's a whole bunch of mapping there. I'm just bringing this up in case some of you have heard about other properties like strongly non-expansive and so on. The only property the reflector really has is non-expansive. There's other good properties that is very good if you care about iterating non-expansive maps and you would like to find fixed points. All the other good properties, they are known for good sufficient conditions to get convergence results. They are all not satisfied there. The only good property that's left is just the mere non-expansiveness. This is really at the boundary. And the last ingredient to prove the result, at least from a conceptual point of view, is this lovely property called Fayer monotonicity. Very nice property if you iterate non-expansive maps in general and would like to prove fixed point and convergence result about these iterations. So what's a Fayer monotone sequence? It's associated to some set. So you have a closed convex set and a sequence. And the sequence is called Fayer monotone if whenever you fix a point in your set and you look at what the sequence does, you get pointwise closer to this point, not just to any point, but to all of the points at the same time. It's not too hard to prove that an equivalent characterization of this, slightly more geometric characterization, is this. If you have a set S that's convex, and you have your current iterate yn, yn plus 1 has to satisfy the following property. If you look at the midpoint between the two points and you draw the perpendicular half space, then the set S has to lie on this side of the half space. That's actually equivalent. So it's a very nice geometric property that shows you get closer and closer to your solution points. Now, whenever you have a Fayer monotone sequence, magic happens, okay? First of all, the sequence will be bounded. That's very clear. If you infimize these inequalities over S, you see that the distance decreases, so this will be a convergent sequence. If you look at the shadow of a Fayer monotone sequence in the underlying set, so the shadow would be here, this is yn, the projection of yn onto S would be this one, ps of yn, here would be ps of yn plus 1. The shadow is always convergent, no matter what. You can prove it's a Cauchy sequence, it always converges. So that's nice, and the question now is when does the original sequence converge to this shadow limit point? It converges if and only if all cluster points of yn actually belong to S. And that's a dream if you want to check convergence. You only have to worry about cluster points. You're already bounded, so you know really the cluster points are the only things that matter, and you only have to take a subsequence and check that the cluster points does what you want. Then you know the whole sequence will converge to what you want. There's no two limits or something. So that's all you have to check. It's a really beautiful property, very useful. So how do you prove this? You observe first that the sequence is Fayer monotone with respect to the intersection of all the constraints. And the reason is very, very simple. If you think about how the sequence was generated, you either project or you reflect. But all these maps are non-expansive. Moreover, the fixed point sets of these maps are either the cone or the constraint Ci. So if you have the updated iterate yk plus 1, this will be an application of yk. You apply a non-expansive operator to yk. So this is T of yk. And if you take a point that is in the intersection of all the constraints, well, this will be a fixed point of the respective operator. So you have this. And because your Lipschitz 1 are non-expansive, you get that. So you get very, very easily Fayer monotonicity. So you are Fayer monotone. That's good, because we will just be done by employing, by checking limit points. Next, if you look at xk plus plus, this is the reflection of xk with respect to the cone. Well, this will lie in the cone. If you believe my lemma about obtuse cones, that's a given there. And moreover, the distance from this reflected point with respect to all the other constraints, the distance from xk plus plus to ci, where ci is any of the other constraints, that will go to zero. Obtusity will give you that into the cone. I pointed that out. How do you get the other things? I just want to show you how you get it for C1. Then you have to do some telescoping and doing triangle inequalities to get it for the rest. But the main idea is illustrated here. Fix two points, namely xk plus plus and the projection of xk plus plus onto the intersection of all the constraints, these two points. Then the distance squared from xk plus plus to the intersection is by definition this. This is the definition of the projection operator. Now, if you view these two points as just two points and you apply the definition of firmly non-expansive to it, which projections are, you get that. This is P1 of the first point minus P1 of the second point, but P1 doesn't do anything to it because we are already in the intersection of all the constraints. So in particular, we are already in C1. So this is P1 of this minus P1 of that. And then the other term with the square is I minus P1 of the two terms and taking the difference of. I minus P1 of this gives me precisely that. And this term will just go away because we are already in intersection. We are in particular in C1. So just by remembering what this means, the projection of xk plus plus onto C1, that's P1 of it. So this term is by definition the same as that. And we can find a lower bound in terms of the distance squared to C of this, because this is just any point in C. So it's maybe closer than the nearest, it's possibly further away than the nearest point of P1 of xk plus plus into C. So we get this by the definition also of the distance. So you get this lovely inequality. Just by rearranging the inequality, we see that this term is less or equal to that distance. Now, we saw already that the entire sequence is Fayer monotone, and if you have Fayer monotonicity, the distance to the set goes down, is convergent. So if you look at the differences, this will converge to a limit. And this will converge to the very same limit, so the difference has to converge to zero. So you have squeezed it now to zero, okay? So you see that the distance from xk++ to the first constraint goes to zero. And if you apply this idea iteratively, you can actually see that the distance of this reflected point to all the constraints will go to zero. So all we have to do is to apply the Fayer result is to check that all the cluster points do what you want, namely lie in the intersection of all the constraints. Well, we are actually in K. That's always true, and the cluster points will also lie in K because the cone is closed. No problem there. If you now compare to the constraints, we have just proven that this distance will go to zero. Now, this is a continuous map. The distance map is continuous. So if you look at cluster points, the cluster points also must belong to Ci. So that's fine, too. And finally, this works for all the i's, so hence all the cluster points have to lie in the intersection. And the last step just essentially puts everything together and employs the little Fayer result. So you have Fayer monotone, all the cluster points are fine, hence the entire sequence will converge to what you want. Now, this was for the subsequences of the reflectors. But because projection operators are non-expansive, hence continuous, you can work your way through the entire sequence. So it's fine. That's the proof. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit about implementations of this. So to keep things simple, we focused on just one obtuse cone, actually self-dual, either the non-negative orthand or the positive semi-definite matrices. And a realistic case is AX equals B. So we have one obtuse cone, one flat, AX equals B. How do you implement the projections or reflections? It's very nice if you have, and motivates the notation plus plus in hindsight. If you are under non-negative orthand, the projection onto the cone just throws away all negative components and sets them equal to zero. The reflection is just almost like taking a complex conjugate. So if you're here, you get up in the cone, right? That would be the reflection. So this is the closed form for the reflection with respect to the negative, non-negative orthand. And the same result essentially holds true for the positive semi-definite matrices. The projection onto the cone would be just this. In the eigenvalue decomposition, you throw away negative eigenvalues. If you want the reflection, you need the absolute values of all of them. So that's all doable. If you want to compute the projection onto the flat, you use the Moore-Penrose inverse. In some sense, this can be done in using the Gram matrix. If you have a representation of your operator, you can do this in Rn. So that's also nice. So how do you actually implement the Gram matrix or the projection? How do you do this? I was just pulling out my linear algebra books and learned about the SVD and whatnot. But so there's several ways of doing it. This is maybe the most pretty one. From a mathematical point of view, you use the singular value decomposition. That's one way. Or very nice is also the McDuffie formula that uses a full rank factorization. But when I talked to Serge about this, he just said, are you crazy, Heinz? You have to use the QR, of course. So that's the way we implemented this, by using the QR. And you have to pre-process the constraints a tiny bit to make it nice and clean. So that's how we implemented the projection onto the flat in Rn for Ax equals b. If you work on a flat in the space of symmetric matrices, you can use the Gram matrix idea I mentioned to do this as well. But again, this is not the recommended way. What Serge said is what we have to do in this case is we have to actually identify, throw away the redundancy work in R T of n, where T of n is the triangular number. So you exploit the redundancy when you deal with symmetric matrices. You translate AX equals B from the symmetric matrices into this space. There's a nice isometry. You just have to be careful with counting things twice and so on. And then you handle the constraints in R T n, just as I explained before with Q R. So this is the setup we looked at. Now I'm going to tell you about the experiments we ran. So we chose R to the 64. We generated 1,000 random problems, all feasible. So you choose an A, you pick a vector, you generate the B. That's how you make them feasible. So they're all feasible. And we changed the dimension of the vector B between 2 and 64. So these are 63,000 problems we looked at. And if you may have wondered why I talked about reflection, projection, and there's a whole continuous family of mappings in between, right? And what about those? And which one is the most efficient one? So to get a feel why this is maybe a good algorithm, we actually looked at this experiment. We allowed a general reflection onto the cone followed by a general reflection onto the flat, okay? So alpha k was here ranging between 0 and 2 and alpha l between 0 and 2 as well, but strictly. Cyclic projections would arise if we set both parameters equal to 1. The reflection projection method I was talking about would arise if we take the reflection onto the cone. And we actually looked at all these maps on a grid, okay, for these random problems. And by the way, the proof I showed you would work also for this situation, but you have to, at the expense of more technicalities. That's one of the reasons I didn't do it. But the proof will essentially go through. So here's a contour plot. It's not very good. The POSCO file looks gorgeous with color, but I don't have a color printer, so this is the best I could do, unfortunately. So this is a contour plot. We counted the iterations. In terms of expenses, they're all essentially the same. And what you see is here, this is an artifact from the copy machine. Here we have the flat parameter. Here we have the cone parameter. And you see that if the flat parameter is very close to 0 or very close to, that should be actually a 2 here. This scale is wrong. This should also go from 0 to 2. Or it's just a part of it. If you choose, this will blow up dramatically. So if you don't project exactly onto the flat, but rather you under-relax or over-relax fairly dramatically, this would be very, very, very slow. Again, if you draw a picture in R2, that's very convincing. But R2 may lie sometimes. The same is true for the cone parameter, although it's not so marked here. What clearly this picture shows you is you should project onto the flat. It's a good idea to project onto the flat. For the cone, this picture doesn't show here too much. Sorry? The meanings? Okay. This is the relaxation parameter with respect to the subspace, the linear subspace, the affine subspace. These are the relaxation parameters with respect to the cone. The method I was talking about would be way up here, right? And cyclic projections would be right in the middle, okay? But we looked at all possible combinations, okay? Okay. This is the same thing as a surface plot, okay? This is the corresponding contour plot to the surface plot. This is iteration counts, how many iterations we needed on average. So when you go to more extreme flat parameters, your iterations go up on average to 5,000 or more. It gets really quite slow. But if you stay with precise projections, you cut down a lot on the number of iterations. Okay. Well, you don't see it from this picture. And if I show you my next plot, you see it. Of course, what we see definitely from the picture is one thing. You should project onto the subspace, right? We all agree on that. That's what this picture clearly suggests. But when you now look at this valley here, how does it look like, right, and compared to the cone? That's what you really want to see, I guess, yeah. That's the next picture. So here I fixed the projection onto the subspace as being exact, always equal to 1. And this is how the iteration count looks like if you just vary the cone parameter, okay? You see, if you under-relax on the cone, that's not good for you. This would be cyclic projections, and if you pump up the relaxation parameter as you go more and more towards reflection, you actually do go down, okay? So, yes? Right.
I mean, this was done over a whole bunch of trials with
random. Right, exactly. I'm not sure what you mean by that. I mean, I don't know about that actually. Yeah. You can actually, if you want, you can run the experiment. we didn't look at that. Okay. Any other questions at this point? Okay, so this is what happens here when you go in the valley and you see you go down by roughly half. We ran also a few experiments in the symmetric matrices. But the more constraints you added, the slower it got, okay? So we didn't get very far away there, unfortunately. So in the last few minutes, I would like to make a few comments on the inconsistent case. What happens if you have, say, two constraints, but they don't intersect? That's a theme that goes a little bit back to Mike Todd's talk yesterday, so. And for that, you don't need obtuse cones. What I'm talking about will be perfectly general for any two sets. So right now, let's change notation entirely. A is not a matrix anymore, but A and B are just two closed convex sets in our underlying Euclidean space with projectors and reflectors, PA and PB. So the first question is, what do you do? What do you mean by the intersection if the sets actually don't intersect? There's a great substitute of the intersection if the sets do not intersect. In order to understand this, we need the idea of the gap vector, which is defined as follows. You have your two sets, A and B. You look at the Minkowski difference, right? At the set of all points that look like B minus A. That's another convex set. That operation preserves convexity. You may have to close it up. You may lose closeness if you add the two sets. But then you have, if you close the set up with this closure operation, you get a nice closed convex set. And then you can ask, if you are in the origin, what's the nearest point in there? Okay, so. And with this vector V, which I'll call here the gap vector, or sometimes called the displacement vector, you can make sense of intersections even though there is none. So the sets E and F that I defined over there are useful substitutes of the intersection, very nice useful substitutes. So if you have defined the gap vector, what you can do is you can take your first constraint set A, and you can intersect it with the translated version of B. Imagine you take B here, this is the gap vector, and you move it in this direction, in the direction minus B, and you intersect. You end up with this little set here. Similarly, if you take A and shift it up and intersect up there, you end up with F. E and F are the substitutes of the intersection, if you want. How can you think about them? You can think about them in this way. You can think about them dually in this way as fixed points of the composition of the projections. Very nice substitutes. And if you are in this generalized intersection, your projections actually are fine. It just gets shifted up by this vector. So that's a good, useful substitute for the intersection. Absolutely, yes, that's an excellent point. If you have some asymptotes, and this is important for the SVP people, it happens there, exactly there. The simplest example you can draw is maybe R2, so you have the non-negative axis, you take the epigraph, say, of 1 over x plus 1 to see it better. So the distance between the two sets is not attained because of the asymptote. However, this gap vector still exists, this vector here, but you're right, there's no intersection, it's empty there. However, if the intersection is non-empty, then you can actually prove something about the method of reflection projection. What does the method do? It projects onto one constraint, reflects on the other. So you care about the composition of the two maps. That's what you really study when you study this method. First of all, the fixed point sets will be very similar to the old one. Because of the reflection, one will be translated even further away. And you can prove this property here. You take any point in A, you look at this iterator of sequences in A, you get this estimate. And from that inequality, you can prove the following. If the gap is realized, if V is actually non-empty, so the situation is not like over there, then you can prove that the sequence AK is actually Fayer monotone with respect to E. However, you have a hard time showing that the cluster points lie in E. That's something we weren't able to do. But you can at least prove Fayer monotonicity. You can prove also that BK minus AK converges in norm to twice the gap vector. So in some sense, you can use this as a heuristic to check for feasibility. If this doesn't go down to zero, your two sets are probably not intersecting at all. You can prove that the average, interestingly, the averages of consecutive iterates actually cluster in E, and the projection onto B also clusters in F. So that's what we get. We could only prove clustering. We couldn't prove full convergence. So there's a nice open problem. To show you just a situation, you cannot prove that the entire sequence, unfortunately, converges to some point in this generalized intersection. And this is an example I'd like to show you because it's really easy to draw and makes the point exactly here. So we have the orthant, and we have a flat that's outside. So this is, and you take now a point. Suppose you're here. I jump right away to the cycle. So if you're here and you reflect into the cone, you end up there. This is the reflection step, RB, I guess. And if you now project onto the flat, you end up down there. And now if you reflect into the cone, you end up here, and you cycle back and forth. So you get these. In the flat, you get a stationary sequence that always bounces around between these two points, reflect, project, reflect, project, reflect, project, and so on, right? However, you can prove that the average is actually nice. The average of these two, AK plus AK plus 1 divided by 2, would be this midpoint here. Oops. And this really is the nearest point in the sense of this gap vector and taking on the distance. So this is something you can prove. AK plus 1 over 2 does indeed cluster in the set of nearest points, but we don't know if the entire sequence actually converges. Here it has to, because there's a unique point in E, right? So all the cluster points have to be this particular unique point, but we don't actually know what's happening in general. So to conclude, so this is, I think, a nice example where the geometry of the constraints is actually taken into account to try to do something more clever with the method of projection. So you exploit here the idea that one of the constraints is actually an obtuse cone, and then you can push much further with respect to reflections. If you do experiments, you do get faster, as we observed. The inconsistent cases has nice open problems here. I think future work would be to use this as a phase one type method, maybe for a feasible interior point methods for SDP. And before, I forgot to bring that up. This comes back to Mike Todd's comment. When is the set E actually non-empty? It will be fine if you have a flat in Rn and the non-negative orthant, because these two sets are polyhedral, so the distance will be fine. You're still closed. But it may go wrong even for the SDPs, and there's nice examples and work by Gabor Pataki and other people that study when this is not attained and so on. Okay. Yes. If you're bounded, you're fine. Yes, that's right. If one of the sets is compact, you're fine. Here are some references. The preprint can be downloaded from Optimization Online. Search made GNU Octave and MATLAB files available for your download with actually the experiments I showed you, so you can compute the standard deviation if you are keen to. It's all there. And in general background on where these methods are used, it's a recent conference proceeding by Dan Butnario, the IS Center, and Shimon Reich. Thanks very much.